I'm Susan Berkelow, and the session that we're going to be doing for this hour is one that was titled up there, Central America, the Church in El Salvador. I didn't get another title to them soon enough, but the title I might have chosen for this, additionally, or call it a subtitle, would be They Speak of Hope, which is the name of a video that I'm going to show during this hour. It's a half-hour video on the Lutheran Church in El Salvador, and also in context of talking about the Lutheran Church, shares something about the reality of that country and its history. My connection with Latin America goes back probably from when I learned Spanish in school and includes some study time in Mexico and in Spain, and also 5 years of working as a missionary in Chile, which was between the years of 73 and 78, which were very critical years both for the church there in determining its identity, what kind of church it was going to be. And certainly, I always call that my seminary education. I went to seminary here afterwards, but it never undid what I learned there. It really made, I was sort of focused in a new way after that experience. In the last few years, I've been coordinating the Lutheran Coalition on Latin America. At the same time, I was also a parish pastor in Los Angeles, working in a bilingual situation in Spanish and English. And most recently, I'm also an associate pastor in a parish in New York City, in the South Bronx. So part of my task for myself has always been making some connections. When I came back from Chile, I wanted to make sense again of what it meant to be an American, because I'd really sort of lost a little of that perspective. And in the meantime, too, also building some bridges. What does it mean to be Hispanic here in solidarity with Latin America, and to be white here, living together with Hispanic people and in solidarity with Latin America? And so I've been learning over the last few years a lot about that, both from Latin Americans in this country as well as in Central America, where I've traveled several times since then. Last year I was in El Salvador twice for the entire month of March, which was part of a larger trip in Central America, and then last August and September, where I was part of a delegation going to the refugee camp, Salvadoran refugee camp in Mesa Grande, Honduras, and then continuing on to El Salvador. And then I returned to Mesa Grande again with Bishop Gomez when he returned on their invitation. So I've also since then been part of some visits Bishop Gomez has made and kept involved in solidarity with that work. So that's something of where my connections have been and my interests. And there's a lot of things that are really exciting happening in Central America that I think are just, it's an invitation for us to grow and to learn and to venture out in new places. And I just would like to share a little of that with you this morning. Have any of you seen this videotape on the Lutheran Church in El Salvador? Okay.
I might have. We showed one here before.
Okay. It may come back to you, but that's what we will be doing. I don't know that I want to say a whole lot more about anything until you've seen that, because it really does do a good introduction, and you'll have some faces to look at that we can mention later. But just what I will do this hour, what I plan to do, is to show this tape that will give you a sense of the church there, and then also to update you what's happened since this tape was made, which I think was in 86, perhaps? I think that was when it came out. There have been a lot of events happening since then, and for us to be aware of what's happening and in what ways we might want to be responding or interacting or otherwise involved in that, and for any questions you might have on that. Oh, I forgot one other question I had. Has anybody heard Bishop Gomez speak in this country? See, that was a question I forgot, several of you. Okay, or anybody else from Latin America in any other presentation? And how about anybody who's traveled to Latin America, who's come back here and shared about their trip? Have you heard any of those presentations? Okay, I think we've now sort of touched on everybody. You all have some connection to this issue. Okay. I'd just like to begin with this tape. We might want to just point out where this is El Salvador. It looks very huge. This map confused me terribly when I was in El Salvador, because I thought of the United States map, on one map. I thought it'd take you days to go across there. It's a very small country. That's about the size of the state of Massachusetts. And there are approximately 6 million people, I think, in the country. So it's the most densely populated in Central America, but also the smallest land space. And just so that you know, this is San Salvador, the capital. And this is Honduras up here, and Guatemala over here, and the Pacific Ocean down here. But the headquarters of the Lutheran Church is in San Salvador, with work in different parts of the country, and that will be pointed out in the video. Another important thing to know is that there's a war in El Salvador, but I think probably everybody knows that. If you've been or talked to anybody, that has to be a fact that we all know. The war is 8 years old and has resulted in thousands of deaths and displacements of people. And for such a small country that's so densely populated, to have in a war going on for so long can't help but turn everything inside out for everything, including the church, and especially the church, as I believe there's no family in that country that has not been touched by the tragedy and violence of that war at least once, if not many times. So I would invite you to turn your chairs around and focus on one of the three, or both if you want, aerial vision.
We see 3D.
Maybe equipped it each
time.
I get a little confused.
He's the story of his church in El Salvador. And now one small church, the Lutheran Church, has suffered persecution and death because it seeks to be faithful to God. A bloody civil war is dividing the tiny country of El Salvador. 45,000 civilians, men, women, and children, have been killed, all of them innocent victims of warfare. Christians in El Salvador have not been immune to the effects of this war.
Cuando la iglesia tiene que hacer un trabajo eminentemente humanitario,
when the church has eminently humanitarian work to do, we don't ask people where they've come from or where they're going. We're not going to let them die. We have to help them. And the authorities don't understand this, so we run risks.
With hundreds of thousands fleeing to the cities for safety, the churches in El Salvador have been providing humanitarian aid. But because of these efforts, churches have been misunderstood, accused of helping the guerrillas.
From the Christian point of view, we feel compelled to participate more actively. Because of this, our church has been hurt. One of our pastors was murdered. He was working in the eastern part of the country, and last year he was murdered. So there are some risks.
For the Christian Church in El Salvador, running risks is a relatively new way of operating. Historically, the church has worked hand in hand with those in authority and with the wealthy. El Salvador was a Spanish colony until its independence in 1821. Its history has been marked by revolutions and military dictatorships. In 1932, Fernando Martí, head of El Salvador's small communist party, led an unsuccessful revolt for better working conditions. As a result, he was executed by General Maximiliano Hernández Martínez, then president of El Salvador. And within 2 weeks, the president ordered the massacre of 30,000 peasants. For the next 50 years, new military ruled behind El Salvador's so-called 14 families who owned and controlled the land and export trade. The gap between rich and poor remained as wide as it had been for centuries, and continues even today. In 1979, a new government was formed with military and civilian participation. But 3 months later, the civilian members resigned when it was clear that the military was in control. In 1980, a coalition of opposition groups, including former members of the government, became organized as the Democratic Revolutionary Front, or FDR. In 1984, José Napoleón Duarte was elected president of El Salvador. Some point to the Second Vatican Council and the Conference of Latin American Bishops, which took place in the 1960s, as turning points for the Church's commitment to the poor. During the same period, the Catholic Church organized base Christian communities. groups of people came together to work the land, share the harvest, and study the Bible. For those in authority, this was a threat to a structure that favored the wealthy. Members of these communities were suspected of inciting dissent and revolution. The persecution of the church had begun. In 1977, a leader in the base Christian community movement, Father Rutilio Grande, was murdered. In 1980, four Catholic churchwomen from the United States were raped and killed by the Salvadoran military. They were suspected of helping guerrillas because of their work with poor and displaced people. For the death squads, looked to Archbishop Oscar Romero for leadership. Monsignor Uriosti was a close friend of Archbishop Romero, who was assassinated by a death squad on March 24th, 1980.
This is the ultimate where he was saying mass that day, and he had started around 6 p.m. and read the first phrase, and then read the Holy Scripture, and he was like in this position when he was preaching, and he preached for about 10 minutes, and then he came to the center of the altar to take the chalice and to take the bread and the wine to offer to our Father God, the sacrifice. And at that precise moment, the bullet came and shot him.
The lack of land, food, education, and jobs had contributed to the civil war now raging in El Salvador. The war has forced more than 1 million people to leave their farms and homes. Over half a million people are displaced within the country.
Displaced persons come from areas where there's been fighting, and sometimes the military thinks that anyone who lives in a certain area in a certain community is automatically a guerrilla. Of course, that's not correct.
Porque ya se empezaba a realizar en los cantones.
There were already starting bombardments, mortar shellings, and invasions in our villages. So out of fear, we had to leave our villages and abandon our houses. Taking young people, and not just young people, but men and women too, away from where they were living, they take them to places where they are tortured, and then later they turn up dead. Children are the most severely affected in a war. Here, malnutrition is terrible. Many children can't study. So we have a lot of illiterate children in the country. And it's always for the same reason. There are no schools where they live.
Here in this community, 7 children used to die every week. That's a great loss. But since the Lutheran Church came to work here, we've had only 1 child die in the space of 1 month.
The war is severely affecting our children and hurting them. It's terribly sad to see young children of the tender age of 4 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old. It's sad to see them not dreaming about the things children that age should be dreaming about. Things like princes and castles and pies and cakes and candy houses. Quite the contrary, our children have violent dreams.
Psicológicamente les afecta mucho porque
psychologically because there are children who are orphaned. Because of the horror of having their mothers disappear and not having a father, they're in the care of people who are not their parents, and that hurts them in school. They don't learn. Not as they would if they had their family's care. And it hurts them. Another thing that does great harm to them is that they have to learn to live in a world of violence.
Because of the crisis and the testimony of love, the role of the church has been changing. We're gradually entering Salvadoran society. Little by little, we're emerging from the anonymity we used to have. People are getting to know us. I feel that all theology is liberation theology. If it's not liberation, it's not theology. Now, if any theology calls for violent methods, we cannot, as Christians, support it. As Christians, we always support peaceful solutions, because obviously, we find in the Bible, which is the Word of God, specifically in the New Testament, the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, who always called on us to solve our problems by peaceful means. We have two ordained pastors and 15 lay pastors. For a small church like we are, with about 6,000 baptized members in the country, it's really a big commitment.
For many Salvadorans, Pastor Medardo Gomez is the Lutheran Church. Through his efforts, the Church founded Fe y Esperanza, the faith and hope community for displaced persons.
We found a group of people who were dying, undernourished children, old men, women. The situation was very sad. Some were half naked, without documents. We took the risk of taking them to the city. Then we took them to another place, to some land we bought to build the community on. Who have suffered much and who have nothing. When they come together to worship God, they express great faith, a great devotion, and a deep gratitude to God.
Shortly after Fe y Esperanza was opened, Pastor Gomez was kidnapped by a group of armed men.
As we started to go back to the car, three people we didn't know stopped us. They threatened us with pistols in their hands, and after they blindfolded us and put handcuffs on us, they made us get into the car and took us away. We didn't know where.
It was around 6 p.m. and I was expecting him because he always comes home at dinner time. But he didn't come at 6, so I waited. By 8 p.m. I was a little worried because I didn't know where he was. By 11 p.m. it was much worse because Medardo never, never comes home that late without letting me know where he is.
As I said, they took us to a strange house, and we were being interrogated there. They told us that they belonged to a group that fought subversion and that they knew that we were subversives.
After 3 days and due to international pressure, Pastor Gomez was released. On the outskirts of the city of Santa Ana, lay Pastor Carlos Nayera came to the aid of a neglected community.
The Lutheran Church is doing this work following Christ's words. He said that whenever we do something for a neighbor or give him something, we're actually doing it for God. But I think it's impossible to just preach the gospel when many people are sick, when many people are hungry. We are drinking polluted water, and I think a lot of people have died because of that. Now that the Lutheran Church has come, they have promised to fight for us little by little. First they say they'll see whether, with God's help and ours, water can be brought from that ridge where the clear spring is.
The work of the health promoters consists of helping out in the clinic because we're trained and others will be trained to care for diseases and to consult on minor illnesses such as diarrhea, malnutrition, parasites, and things like that.
In San Salvador, the Lutheran Church also operates a clinic offering medical, dental, and psychological assistance. Job training is another part of the church's ministry. In the community of Canaan, a name which means God's promised land, families fleeing from the war are starting a new life.
The problems that we have are of basic needs. That is, we need help now because we don't have the strength to survive by ourselves. We're asking for help, just a start, just the beginning.
They've given us money, grain, and moral support. They're the only ones who believe that we want something other than a refugee camp. So we don't always want to be expecting people to bring us things. We do want help, but we don't expect to have everything handed to us.
Church workers Cecilia Alfaro and Santiago Rodriguez are helping displaced farmers to work the land once again.
We started working here 3 years ago with about 15 farmers, some of whom are here now.
We depended on the church's help to set this cooperative up because by ourselves we couldn't do it. We needed help.
Santiago was taken by the national police shortly after this segment was taped. 5 days later, he was released. Arrests of Christians are a form of government intimidation of the church.
People of the church have been assassinated. People have been disappeared. People have been arrested and tortured. There isn't a family in that church that hasn't had a member of their immediate family profoundly affected in one of those very hurtful ways by the war.
Maria Grande de Portillo was taken prisoner by the national police. They accused Maria and the church of channeling money to the guerrillas.
They threatened me. If I didn't tell them what I knew, they had my son, and he would suffer the consequences. But I was acting in good faith and relying on the power of God. You show your Christian faith more because sometimes the pressure gives you the courage to take it, even under heavy pressure. I remember one time, because I wouldn't answer them about the church-run refugee centers, they subjected me twice to electric shocks.
Pastor David Fernandez's mutilated body was found in a ditch outside the city of San Miguel. An investigation has led to the arrest of two men, both related to the Salvadoran military.
The situation of human rights in El Salvador now is not great. There are violations both by the government and by the guerrillas. The government has problems, serious problems in the way the war is being conducted.
Church volunteer John Lamb was almost killed while delivering food to flood victims. Government soldiers stopped the church van with a rash of bullets.
We had 18 bullet holes in the vehicle, two injured persons. They shot out the back glass, and the bullet holes come right along at head level until it gets where I was, and then the bullet holes kind of miraculously go up over head level.
At the Office of the Commission on Human Rights, Francisco Martinez speaks of the continued violence in El Salvador. Death squads, although not as active as they were in the early 80s, still use brutal methods to murder people.
They have changed their ways of killing people. It's not unusual to find 5 to 10 bodies in one place. But there are bodies that just disappear, so they won't be seen publicly.
Francisco Martinez was arrested by the military shortly after the segment was taped. He is now in prison in San Salvador. In 1977, a group of women organized Comadres, a committee of mothers dedicated to helping the families of the thousands of Salvadorans who have disappeared.
At this very moment, I don't know if my son is dead or alive. He disappeared almost 4 years ago. Now in March, it's going to be 4 years since he disappeared, and I beg the foreigners to stop the war so that we'll have peace here in El Salvador. Because we can't stand the situation. We're hungry, we have no clothes, we have no place to live. We live in great misery, and so I beg them, from the bottom of my heart, and in the name of Almighty God.
Now, the arms help from the United States to these countries, $500,000 daily. You are a rich nation. You have all the money you want. You have everything. But don't send us arms. Don't send us weapons. We don't need them. Our people are dying because you are sending those arms. So this is the way we ask you to help us, not to send weapons. Send us the food we need. Send us technology. Send us science. Everything, but not arms, not weapons.
I feel the hardest thing for us in El Salvador is the war. And until the war stops, no matter how good the intentions of the churches and the humanitarian institutions, no matter how active we are in our work, we can't stop the pain of the situation in El Salvador. This will end only with the end of the war. Solidarity with us from outside the country is so important to us in El Salvador. First of all, we Salvadorans need peace. But we can't achieve it overnight with the violence that's going on. I think our foreign brothers and sisters through the churches first should remember us in their prayers. Because prayer is very strong and it reaches God.
If the United States is really concerned about peace, I think it will find ways to put pressure on both sides to resolve the conflict and give us peace.
But when you look around the country, you look around at the circumstances people live in, and at the war, and at the seeming intransigence and interminableness of the situation, it's amazing and miraculous to sense the hope among people who are doing the kind of work that is being done by the church.
Instead of running away, quite the contrary, our faith in God gives us strength, and that makes us want to go forward and serve. It's true that we live with fear and anxiety. We're scared, but we're not crushed, not destroyed. I think fear is something natural. What's important is the security we have in God.
They all think they know, although there's no, they don't, you know, so there's no real defined that. Yeah, that's a good question. I should say, just in terms of updating, I'll mention that in a second. Some of the people that were on that film, too, are no longer in El Salvador, and I don't know what's happened to each of them, but I do know that, for instance, the young woman who said she'd been tortured, Maria Grande de Portillo, is in Mexico, I believe, with her brother, and just last year, the rest of her family also left because just the continued persecution. What you heard mentioned here, the people who were identified are people who were arrested by the military, by security forces, and they are very identifiable because they wear uniforms. There are also some people who are semi-identifiable but not as obviously identifiable, and they include a lot of the death squad activity that was very, very prevalent around the 1980s, but a lot of the right-wing groups that think the military is too soft and the military has been very brutal in dealing with particularly the campesinos have also been active recently. And so a lot of them are suspected, if not being actual military themselves, or at least connected to the military or simply further to, in fact, more reactionary than the military has been. The Contras are not really part of the scene in El Salvador. They are part of a bigger scene, the regional picture, and as a result, they do represent a disruptive, but an aggressive force within the region that has been pushing conflict rather than moving towards peace. And so, when Bishop Gomez is asked, for instance, how he feels about the Contras, I mean, he's very careful. I've heard him answer a lot of questions. And one of the things that I really try to do is listen to what Latin Americans are saying about their situation and try to see what their perspective is, because they're the ones that are affected by this most deeply. And his assessments of the Contras are, for the majority of them, particularly the leadership, and now recently even more obviously so, are people who have been involved in violent conflict, even under Somoza's regime, and that the force that they represent is one that is not working towards peace, but one that will ultimately just cause more destruction. His concern is that if they were ever just no longer supported, He says, what would happen to these people? I said, all they're trained to do right now is fight, and they're going to end up in Honduras or El Salvador or Costa Rica, and what are these people going to do? And so he sort of turns it around in the end to a pastoral concern, like, you know, how is anybody going to be able to help these people after what their focus has been? So the scene basically is, and I'll mention a little more along the way here perhaps of who the main characters are in this conflict that is there. I'd just like to mention now five things that have happened, sort of major events that are happening on the Central American scene that are really changing things and bringing things, in a sense, to a point where they really cannot be ignored. Something is going to happen, and we certainly need to be responding to them. One is, you heard about the harassment of people that happened as they testified to themselves. In the last year and a half, that harassment has increased in rather major portions. As I mentioned, the early 80s, at the beginning part of the war, there was just a tremendous amount of bloodshed. And then they started to say, well, with Duarte, things were sort of calming down and it wasn't quite as violent. But in effect, there was just some shifting of activity. In recent years now, the violence has increased once again. For a long time, well, right up till I visited the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador last September, and they were saying, oh, there are no death squads in El Salvador. Those haven't been around for years. But at the same time, in the last 2 years, there have been a lot of appearances of bodies with torture marks on that were sort of the mark of the death squads. And a lot of things have happened. For instance, the bomb that was placed in Fey and Esperanza, in that refugee community of Fey Esperanza, they eventually last year moved most of the people out to a new area and were leaving basically just children there. They wanted to turn it into an orphanage. It's sort of their vision for that area. It also made a safer place for the children if all the adults moved out, because they were less likely to be accused of being guerrillas. However, last September, suddenly somebody put a bomb in the middle of their daycare center that went off at 3 a.m. and just blew the place apart. It very upset the church, because this was most of the adults have been moved out already for 8 months, and so there was no real reason to suspect anything going on there. And for it to be placed in the daycare center, even if it was in the middle of the night and there are no children there, was really taken to be more of a message that, you know, tonight the daycare center, where no people around, but who knows tomorrow what that means. And Lutheran Church took it very much as a message that their work with the poor and the displaced was being looked down on by a number of violent factions. So that was one example, rather dramatic example, of the kind of pressure the church has been on now just in the last year and a half. Also, more people have been arrested out of the church. There are at least 20 people from the church, the congregation in San Salvador, who were picked up last year. People from the repopulated communities have also been picked up and have been tortured. So these attacks have continued to come in various forms on the church, either by attacking their camps, their refugee camps, or also by the cooperatives that are functioning there. They either kidnap the leaders and just intimidate the rest, or have tried to block food shipments to these camps they're very dependent upon. Also recently, just in the last few months, a major focus of military energy has been on the foreign workers in El Salvador. It's been, for the last several years now, the presence of Europeans and North Americans in El Salvador has been considered a really important factor in the protection of these people. They have been present in refugee camps. They have been present in some of the social service work of the church. They've accompanied a lot of people as they go about their daily business. And above all, they've been witnesses to what has happened. So people don't die in El Salvador without somebody knowing and without the rest of the world knowing. But recently, there's been a lot of pressure on the foreign workers, and a request that's come to us from the church there has been for us to also apply pressure so that the government's not able to expel the foreign workers. And you heard in the tape that the Lutheran Church in El Salvador has two Salvadoran pastors and about a dozen, they call them, they're sort of lay pastors. Bishop Gomez refers to them as pastors at the level of deacon. So he sort of created this other category. But basically what's happened is that the Lutheran Church has grown tremendously in the last few years. And it's seen as directly a result of their witness with the people, of living with the people, of responding to the needs of people. As I heard Bishop Gomez say on Friday, he was at Lutheran Human Relations Institute giving the keynote address. He said, I used to be just an ordinary parish pastor, and the business of the church was going along okay, and the church was growing normally, and we were doing what churches do. He said, but we really didn't have the joy that we have now. And he said it wasn't until they started responding to what was going on in their country where they saw the plight, as he described it, the plight of refugees within their own country, and started to do the work there. You may know that in 86 he was consecrated bishop. He had been president of the church before, but they changed within the church their structure so that it was ecumenically perhaps more parallel to the other churches in the area. But he chose Fe y Esperanza refugee camp as the place for his consecration because of the identification of the ministry of the church with the poor, with the displaced, with those who are being persecuted. And as a result, the church has grown, and there have been places throughout the country where they needed workers, and with only two pastors, they couldn't get everywhere. So there's been a training program for these other pastors. But also, they have about 100 foreigners who are working with them in the different areas, social service areas of the church. Lutheran World Federation employs several people working primarily in agriculture. And the agricultural cooperatives have also been very much under a lot of harassment by the government. But basically, the harassment of the camps and the foreign workers and continued attacks on the church and the cooperatives. 2 years ago when I came up to Holden Village, it was, well, 86, in June of 86, Bishop Gomez and Cecilia Alfaro had been denounced on television as being cooperating with the guerrillas. They said they are communists. Now, whenever they say this on public TV, it's sort of like forewarning, you're going to be arrested or killed. It's a way of almost making a public announcement of that fact if they feel bold enough to make an accusation on TV. And I remember I was coming up to Holden Village and somebody brought this word, and so we had this great letter writing campaign in Holden that first 2 days of writing letters to the embassy and to the government and saying, you know, we heard about this accusation of Bishop Gomez and we don't think this is, we know this not to be the case, that they're doing work, mission and work of the church. And it was interesting because nothing happened after that. He wasn't arrested, they weren't kidnapped, which is very unusual. Almost always that is a natural consequence. But the embassy has also said that they had never received such a volume of correspondence on any issue as they had on that one. And so it was a reminder, and he reminds us of those things as well, that what happens here, the power that we have in terms of providing, even at a distance, some measure of solidarity and support for the church there. Besides the incidents of harassment and attacks, there are a couple of other really positive things that are going on. One was the peace process, which is happening. You probably read about Esquipulas, the peace agreement that was signed in Guatemala last August. It's been through sort of a rocky history now the last few months, but everybody there sees that as sort of a difficult, distant, but also very important step towards the region determining their own process for peace, as opposed to other countries, such as the United States particularly, trying to determine that. But along with that, there's been a real resistance to the peace process, particularly in El Salvador, which our government does not see fit to denounce very often. You probably know more about any slight way that Nicaragua has not complied with any point of the peace agreement, but you may not be aware of the different ways that El Salvador, and particularly in Honduras, have not and have resisted, particularly around the issue of human rights. And so there's a lot of obstacles to this, but people are feeling that that's an important step. Mm-hmm.
This plan you spoke of, is that the Arias plan?
Yes, it's the plan that he presented that was agreed upon. They always referred to it as Esquipulas, which is the place they met in, but that's sort of how they referred to it. It's interesting, we refer to it as the Arias plan, but they referred to it as the place where it was signed. But as a result, too, even as steps toward peace are made, there's also been a great increase in the amount of violence. So it's a contradictory sort of thing in a way, but it's also considered positive, at least, at this point. A fourth thing is the fact of what's happened to the refugees and displaced people. And this is really an incredible thing to me, and I'm going to talk about it more in another session. But basically, the refugees have also taken upon some self-determination. Beginning last year, in 86 in June and July, and last year in January, a group of refugees displaced in their own country decided they wanted to return to their homes, and they just packed up and left, even though the military did not want them there. The major relocation of refugees happened, though, last October from Honduras. There was a camp of 12,000 people in Mesa Grande, Honduras, and they decided after 7 years of being refugees, after having seen their houses burned, seeing their people massacred and having survived to go to Honduras to live in a camp, in a rocky camp on the top of a plateau in the middle of nowhere, they decided they wanted to go home. Their kids needed to have some Salvadoran soil. They needed to have the possibility of working. They needed to have their hope a little more concrete. And so they organized international support for themselves, and together with delegations that accompanied them, almost 5,000 of them returned to their homes in the war zones in El Salvador. And that, in spite of the government not wanting them to do that, in spite of a lot of agencies resisting it, they managed to do that. Also in this country, the refugees have organized themselves in very unique ways to provide help for each other. And there have been a number of groups that are helping them with that. So they are not by no means just victims of this, but they have also taken upon themselves the their future and are inviting us to be a part of that. And that is something that's been very exciting, I think, and very different for us in this country. We're used to offering sanctuary, sort of like I was thinking of the Bible study, the matins this morning. We're used to offering sanctuary to people who are homeless, but here we have people saying, no, we want you to help us as we go about doing what we need to do, and we want you to accompany us. And it's a different role for us to be the accompaniers and not the leaders or the recipients in that sense. But that's an exciting thing that is happening as well. And one final thing I just want to mention, lift up, is a document that was signed this April in Nicaragua, signed by over 100 Central Americans from Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, Nicaragua, including from Brazil and a couple other places. And this document is called Kairos, Central America. Has anybody heard of this document? Probably not. Nobody's heard of this document yet. It's very fresh. But you probably have heard of the South African Kairos document that was signed a couple of years ago that describes the situation in Central America as a particular historical moment, a moment of opportunity, a moment to act. And in this document, there is a sharing of what the reality is in Central America in each of these countries. They talk about the signs of the kingdom they see in their midst, and they also include some challenges to the communities, both in Central America and in North America, challenges to the churches and challenges to the governments. And it's a document that we really would like to have people become familiar with. I'm going to see if we can put a couple of these in the library, so if during the week you would like to read this, it'll be in there and you can find that. But it's sort of the first collective statement that has come out in some kind of way that really says, dialogue with us. This is our reality. These are the ways that we can work together for peace, for a better place, better situation for all of us. I think it's something that's going to be very important in the coming months and also years. As they point out, we're really at a critical juncture in history where either we will be able to work for peace or we will perhaps be condemned to continue a history of a lot of oppression. It's been Central America's history.
Is that a church-related document?
Yes, it is a church-related document, and it's signed by people, and they list the churches that they belong to. They're basically, it's very ecumenical. It includes Catholic, Baptist, Mennonite, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, and I don't know what else, but basically all of those. Mm-hmm.
Basically, at least as far as the Seattle-Tacoma area, there's very little news at all. I mean, nothing hardly in the papers, ever. The last year, I heard one of the priests who works with the resistance movement speak, and he spoke of in terms of that he felt that at least 3/5 of the country was being controlled by the resistance movement. What is your assessment, or can you even find an assessment to how the conflict is going, the violent conflict? Or do you know?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, but basically in the last year and a half also, there's been a significant increase in activity of the FMLN, which is the military part of the opposition to the current Salvadoran government. And they've had some very large attacks on military bases. And what was really striking about one of them happened when I was in El Salvador last March. What happened was it was a very large base in El Paraíso, sort of the northwestern part of El Salvador. But the fact that it was happened from the inside as well as the outside was caused a lot more repression on the government because they became very insecure. It means that the resistance and the opposition is so great that they're able to be within the military and nobody know it. So it seems like there's a great pervasiveness of opposition, military opposition to the government now that has grown and has become more effective in what they're doing. So people have been speculating that this year, possibly there will be still a major offensive that may change the war, that people are very tired of the war. And the military has not gotten more popular. Some of the supporters of the military have gotten more vocal and have had some recent political success, but it's generally not accepted. I wouldn't have any idea of figures, though, in that. But,
yeah. How does what the Lutheran Church is doing interface with what the basic Christian communities are doing, which seem to be primarily Catholic? Are they working together in any way, or I almost get the sense that they're doing really quite different things.
There is actually a common working together. There is a person, one of the people working in the church, Lutheran Church in El Salvador, is assigned to be the liaison with the base Christian communities. We were there in last March. Also, the base Christian communities were having a weekend retreat at Fe y Esperanza, the Lutheran refugee camp. And so there was just a lot, it was a really ecumenical event as well. So there's been a lot of support. And what's really interesting, particularly with Bishop Gomez, is that since Archbishop Romero died, people were looking for some figure who could stand. I mean, the symbol is very important in El Salvador, the symbol of the person with the authority in the position. And Bishop Gomez has become that symbol for many Salvadorans, even who are Catholic. And you'll hear even Roman Catholics say, our Bishop Gomez. You know, they'll claim him because he is that symbol. And so I think in many cases, like in Chile too, it happened, when you're under severe repression, some of those denominational barriers are much less visible, and you find you need each other to survive, and you find that you're more on the same side than the different side. So I think there's been a lot of feeding of each other and sharing of resources among the churches. So, yes?
One of the pleas that was quite plain on this tape was that we should stop sending them arms and start sending them some other kinds of things. I have two questions in that regard. One, would the government there have access to the arms market and the international arms market if the United States failed to send them arms, so that wouldn't make any difference? And secondly, if the answer to that is no, what sort of concrete things can we do to bring about a cessation of sending American manufactured arms to the government in that country?
That's a very good question. I've also heard Bishop Gomez respond very strongly in that way. He said, arms are killing, arms are not helping, we need to stop them. And I heard him say on Friday night too, he said, I think the United States needs a change of government this year. Mm-hmm. That was a very concrete suggestion he made. Mm-hmm. I think that my impression is that repressive forces everywhere will always have a market willing to feed them arms. That's true. But for me, the question is not can they get arms from someplace else, but for me, this affects my integrity if my government is giving arms in that kind of a situation. I think our own concept of our salvation demands a moral response from us. So regardless of what the consequence might be, I think we need to respond to that situation in a different way. Over $3 billion U.S. dollars have gone down there, and most of them have been military dollars, gone to military aid.
Bullets, not dollars, right?
Pardon?
For bullets and not dollars.
Oh, also dollars, yeah, but both. Yeah. And so I think that when bills come up in Congress, I think being very active in the legislature is going to be a very important thing for us. And again, even though I was talking about El Salvador this hour, most Central Americans say it's all connected. You know, you send bullets to one country and they somehow end up in the other country too. I mean, you can shoot across borders and it happens. So I think that being actively involved in the foreign policy decisions in any way is going to be a very important thing for us to do. And that includes the contra-aid, which Bishop Gomez has also spoken out against very strongly. So we are coming to the end of our hour. And we need to end this meeting here right now. And if any of you would like to find out about more resources now after we've ended or have some other questions, I'd be glad to stay a few minutes. But I promise I will stop after an hour. So you are free to go if you need to go and if you want to go to lunch. But I also look forward to talking to any of you at any other time while we're here outside of this hour, because I think it's really important and exciting possibilities for us that we need to look at.
Thank you very much.